gentlemen, welcome to the highlight of the conference. This is the family you've all been waiting for patiently. And the moment is here, and I can see you all fiddling your seats waiting for you to begin. So I'm going to be brief and let our panelists do most of the talking. What I'm going to talk about this morning is the structure of the Constitution. Not individual provisions, not a myopic look at one part of the Constitution at a time, but the question of how does the Constitution work as a document, the Bill of Rights, work as a document? How does an interpretation of a particular provision of the Constitution bear on not simply that particular provision, but upon the way the document works as a whole. The centerpiece of the discussion, will be Professor Amar's paper, which is forthcoming in the, I think in the next issue of the Yale Law Journal. And I've been asked to read a note here yesterday, and it will go all over the world to buy a lifetime subscription in the journal. So for my Alan Cesar, my future lawyer, who's an editor. Yeah, it is indeed an excellent piece of work, a very thought-provoking piece of work. It is the kind of legal scholarship that it goes precisely to the heart of what the federal society is meant to do and what established to do. I wrote an article some years back complaining about the phrase that Chief Justice Marshall used. It is a constitutional rights boundary. And my complaint was that the phrase has been used to interpret the Constitution in a way different from other documents. I had kind of an excuse to squint and rather looking at the words of the Constitution or the structure to treat it in a different, more distant way. And my complaint there was that you then lose the philosophy of the document itself. It makes it very easy which is quite enough to read not what's the famous provisions of the document, but what effects going on with judges on the head. We're going to Professor Moss' paper, and the commentaries to it, and Professor Langmaning's comments, which are somewhat different topics that are related to this subject matter, will get away from that type of constitutional education. I'm going to simply say we have a distinguished panel. We have the most distinguished panel here. That's so distinguished that I'm not going to bore you with reading their lengthy biographies. The folks put together a conference and put together biographies, which are materials. I encourage you to read those and commit it to memory. I would note that we are very heavily influenced by Yale. Professor Amar went to Yale, was an undergraduate in law school, is a professor here. Professor Smith teaches here, Professor Langman teaches here. And I have a son in Yale, so. I was a very spotty at once. What we're going to do is we're going to lead off with Professor Amar giving us a discussion or synopsis of his paper. I do want to encourage all of you here to at least buy the one copy of the year watch, or at least photostatic somewhere. It is a remarkable piece of legal scholarship. I read a lot of stuff, legal scholarship and otherwise, and I can tell you it's a remarkable piece of work. It will
give us a lot of food for thought today, and I know that for years to come.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank the Federalist Society for putting the panel together and putting that in person to invite me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you and to be on these panels, especially because so many other interesting people are brought together and we don't always agree. I find that I learn a lot more when that happens than when all like-minded folks are brought together. Let me try to explain, if I might, in the time that I have, what I mean by the title of this paper, The Bill of Rights as a Constitution. Professor Burns wrote a very thoughtful essay called The Constitution as a Bill of Rights some years ago. And he was picking up the phrase of Hamilton's in Federalist Number 84, in which Hamilton argued that the Constitution was, for every important purpose itself, a Bill of Rights. What Hamilton meant by that, I think, is that the structure of government played a very important role in protecting freedom and protecting against government tyranny. And that although the Constitution doesn't have lots and lots of thou shalt not provisions, it has some, Article 1, Section 9, restricting Congress, and Article 1, Section 10, restricting the states, its main emphasis, as anyone who just passingly looks at the document, is on more self-consciously structural issues like federalism, separation of powers, bicameralism, representation, and constitutional amendment. And Hamilton was arguing that through these devices, liberty would be protected and government held in check. Hamilton also argued in the Federalist Number 84 that the preamble was profoundly important, that most of the important rights of the people were retained simply by the language of the preamble and the philosophy it represented. We, the people of the United States, to ordain and establish this Constitution. What he meant by that is that here we have a document emanating from a popular sovereign, and popular sovereignty, or what Lena Braille would probably call just democracy or majoritarianism, is an important device for securing liberty, especially the public liberty of democratic or collective self-governance. What I'd like to suggest today is that if you look carefully at the Bill of Rights, we'll actually see it as being much less discontinuous with the original Constitution than most of us have been led to believe. Most of us tend to think, the conventional reading is, the Bill of Rights is fundamentally, paradigmatically, not about structure, not about things like federalism, bicameralism, representation, constitutional amendment. Most of us also think that the Bill of Rights is not about majoritarianism. It's self-consciously counter-majoritarian. It's about individual rights. It's about majority rights. I think that's wrong. I think the essence of the Bill of Rights and the essence of the Constitution are profoundly populist, democratic, majoritarian, and structural. Let me try to get at that two ways. One, let me remind you that Charles Beard and others, notwithstanding, those who adopted a constitution were revolutionaries. They saw themselves as revolutionaries. In their own era, they were radical Democrats. It is true that they were profoundly exclusion from the perspective of 1991, women, slaves, etc. But from the perspective of 1787, the process by which the Constitution became the supreme law of the land was more fundamentally participatory and democratic than anything that had ever preceded in the history of the planet. Previously, societies had been chartered by individual great man lawgivers claiming a pipeline to God, Moses on Sinai, Solon, Lycurgus. Even in the American experience, the predecessor to the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, were never adopted by the people of the states. None of the state constitutions were except for New Hampshire and Massachusetts in 1784 and 1780, respectively. So the pre-existing state constitution hadn't involved the populace view of the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution did. Look at the most important, the constitutive part of the original Constitution. That Article 7 says, by a simple majority vote and a specially convened convention, the people of Virginia could make this Constitution their supreme law. And so when you look at the preamble, we the people of the United States, which sounds so populist, or Article 7, the last article of the original Constitution, its essence, I would argue, is fundamentally a participatory, democratic, majoritarian, at the most important level, which is the level of who gets to make the Constitution, and therefore who can unmake it. Ordinary day-to-day governance, of course, is a little bit more detached from the people. Indirect election, filtered presidency, a judiciary that's still more enslaved. But for the process of constitutional creation, Article 7, extraordinarily majoritarian democratic. And so I've argued at previous Federalist Society meeting, the process of constitutional amendment is similarly majoritarian. I don't believe that Article 5 is the exclusive mechanism by which the Constitution can be amended. I think the people retain, and here I'm using the phrase the people to mean that collective popular sovereign, retain an unalterable, inalienable, indefeasible right to alter and abolish their government by simple majority votes, especially in convened conventions. That's how the Constitution was adopted in 1787, state constitutions notwithstanding, and that's how it can be amended. What I want to argue is the Bill of Rights is consistent with that vision. That phrase, the people, appears twice in the original Constitution, the preamble and in Article 1, talking about the people voting for Congress. There is no phrase that appears more often original Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of the phrase, the people, and they mean it collectively. They mean it in its paradigm, its core, its essence, to be about popular sovereignty. It's there in the first, the right of the people to assemble, petition. It's there in the second, the right of the people to keep in their arms. It's there in the fourth, it's there in the ninth, it's there in the tenth. And in every case, one can understand the echoing of that popular sovereignty motif of the original Constitution. Let me very briefly, in the time that I have left, try to suggest a very different reading from the clause, of the various clauses of the Bill of Rights that you've probably heard in law school. And I think each one of these may sound a little odd to you, but I think when you put them together, it's not very odd to you. But in a way whose, I think, overall kind of consistency and harmony suggests that. The original Bill of Rights was rather different from the way we imagined it. Let me, before I do that, say one final thing. We may today have a Bill of Rights that is appropriate and that we deserve, a very different one from the one that was created 200 years ago. But I would suggest, in large part, if that's so, if the transformation of the Bill of Rights has been legitimate on interpretiveness grounds, for those who want to take seriously the document as a whole, it is only because the Bill of Rights is profoundly changed when it gets incorporated against the states via the 14th Amendment. So the debate really will turn on whether the 14th Amendment was appropriately about incorporating the Bill of Rights against the states. And if that case can be made, there's a big debate there, and I don't want to enter it here, then the essence of the Bill of Rights becomes very different, because the Reconstruction is about protecting minorities. It's about protecting counter-majoritarian rights in a way that the original Constitution, I argue, was not. Very briefly, there are 12 original amendments that are proposed by the first Congress. Only the last 10 are radical. So the thing that we call the First Amendment wasn't the First Amendment. The original First Amendment actually had to do with government size. It said Congress needs to be bigger than it. There has to be a secure minimum size of Congress going beyond what Article 1 provides. That is, in its essence, a structural provision about representation. And the idea is that liberty will best be protected if you have a government that's much more representative of the people. That's a majoritarian provision, in essence. The concern was, because Congress was so small, it would be unrepresentative of people. Only a few great elite men would get into office, and they wouldn't have a sense of fellow feeling and sympathy with ordinary constituents. So the original First Amendment was designed to cure that, to tighten the link between Congress and their constituents. A majoritarian kind of amendment, an amendment about structure and representation. Another way to put my global theme, before I talk about the original Second Amendment, Second Amendment was about Congress not being able to vote itself a pay increase until there had been an intervening election. Once again, concerns about structure of government, about government self-dealing, about the possibility of an unrepresentative government. That's a majoritarian provision, too. Here's the other way of putting the point. Let's recall Federalist Number 51. Madison says there are two basic issues in government. One is protecting citizens generally against an unrepresentative government. In a corporation, if you set up a board of directors and managers, maybe they'll try to run the corporation or the company in their own interest and not in the interest of the shareholders. That's the first problem, though, making sure that the folks in government aren't just sort of doing things for their own benefit. The second issue, Madison says, is protecting a minority from a majority of fellow citizens. It's like protecting a minority of shareholders from a majority of shareholders. What I want to argue is that the original Bill of Rights was much more about the first issue, what economists would call the agency problem of government, than it was about the second issue. It's much more about protecting majorities of citizens from possibly unrepresentative, elitist governments. We see that in the original First Amendment, which comes within one state of being adopted. Only Delaware votes against it. And Delaware votes against it because Delaware likes a small Congress, because Delaware gets a bigger proportion share of smaller Congress. So 10 of the states ratify it, one doesn't. The other, last 10 amendments were just ratified by 11, so that's the only difference between why the last 10 get in and the original first doesn't. The Second Amendment, the original Second Amendment, clearly that government self-dealing. Let's take our First Amendment. Our First Amendment today is often understood as being about individual autonomy, self-expression, personhood, and those perhaps are important things. I don't want to suggest that they're not there at all. They're not the core, they're not the essence, the paradigm. The original Bill of Rights is not even about protection, it's about, as Alexander Michael John pointed out, it's about democracy, about representative government, and the need for constituents to be able to participate in that representative process, to voice their views. It's also about protecting a majority of people from a possibly unrepresentative government. The paradigmatic First Amendment rights holder is not Jehovah's Witnesses or communists or unpopular speakers. It's the Republican Party of 1800 that actually has a majority of the citizens and an unrepresentative Congress is trying to suppress their speech. That's why, for example, these guys are trying to make their arguments that the Alien Sedition Acts are unconstitutional to a jury. A jury is a more populist body. A jury will protect popular speech criticizing government. And that's why there's this deep linkage between First Amendment and free speech and jury trial with Zanger and the Alien Sedition Acts. Today, because we think the First Amendment is counter-majoritarian, we distrust juries and we try to get issues to judges rather than juries. The right of the people. One final thing about the Alien Sedition Act. This is about government trying to keep itself in office. It's a crime to criticize an incumbent congressperson, but it's not a crime for the incumbent congressperson to criticize his challenger. Okay, this is about people in government entrenching themselves in office, the agency problem, the self-dealing problem of government. The original right of the people to assemble is about the right of the people to assemble in conventions to alter and abolish their government. The Second Amendment is in large part about protecting the right of revolution against an unrepresentative government and protecting against a federal standing army, which an unrepresentative government tried to use an army to suppress the majority of citizens and repress democracy. So too with the Third Amendment, it's not so much about privacy, it's about controlling a federal government that's going to have the army and therefore be able to repress the majority of citizens. The Fourth Amendment is in large part about making sure that people whose houses are searched can get to an unrepresentative government, can can get to a jury. The key clause of the Fourth Amendment is that government searches and seizures have to be reasonable. Now, today, judges are deciding that. 200 years ago, reasonableness was a question for the jury to decide. Once again, the idea was that local and populist institutions like juries would keep an unrepresented, possibly unrepresentative government in check. The Fifth Amendment, let's put aside the takings clause. I think that's a little bit more purely Madisonian in its nature. It's a little bit more of an individual rights provision than the rest. Another way of seeing the point that the rest aren't is that they only apply against the federal government and not the states. A federal government is a government that actually is going to be less representative. But as Federalist 10 tells us, there's not going to be a majority tyranny problem with the federal government the way there is with the states. So rest of the Fifth Amendment, due process means in its core, in its essence, presented by good and lawful men, that's grand jury, again, right, the people that participate in government through jury trial, which is much more populist in its essence. Double jeopardy is about protecting the integrity of an original jury verdict against being overturned. The jury is featured in three separate amendments, in the Fifth grand jury, in the Sixth criminal jury, in the Seventh civil jury, and it's not just about the litigants' rights to have a jury, it's about the people's rights to be on the jury, to participate in government. This is the jury as a democratic public school, educating citizens in their rights and duties. It connects to Frank Easterbrook's point about how the Constitution, to really make a difference, has to be the lived experience and be integrated into the culture. And part of the way to do that is to have juries in the Fourth Amendment context. When a government official breaks into your house without good reason, you sue that person, you get to a jury. It's a civil jury, it's a Seventh Amendment jury, but again, it's a jury that's keeping an eye on government unconstitutionality. Why do we have the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, and bail? It's in part because in sentencing and setting bail, judges are acting without juries and therefore are less to be trusted because these guys are permanent government officials, just like people in the standing army are permanent government officials and less to be trusted. If you want a militia to check the populist, the localist militia, to check a nationalist, elitist standing army, populist and localist jurors to check an elitist and more central, more nationalized set of federal judges. The Ninth and Tenth Amendments, Tenth is clearly about federalism in part, but when they talk about the rights of the people, they are paradigmatically not talking about things like individual privacy. That's John Stuart Mill, 1840, that's 14th Amendment, 1867. But in 1789, that's really not what the people is about, that's not what liberty is about. They're talking about collective rights, paradigmatically, like the right of the people to alter and abolish their government through these devices, like conventions, as I tried to argue in our conference. That's pretty much sort of just a sweep through the Bill of Rights. I'll shut up now, there's a lot more that I can't quite go into, but I'm sure it'll be picked up by others.
Some 14 years ago, I had a meeting in Washington. I think more by federal judges and law school professors. I get the comments that probably wasn't the law school in the country that didn't have a constitutional law course. Probably not many that did not make that constitutional law course. Probably required curriculum. But that I did not know of any law schools that taught a course on the Constitution as such. And no one in that audience said nay to me. And of course, that's what struck me especially about Professor Hamas' paper. He obviously teaches constitutional law, looks at the Constitution as a whole, and that I find refreshing. He looks at the Bill of Rights holistically, as he says, insisting that its meaning is greater than the sum of its various parts. He acknowledges that its various provisions were designed to protect individuals and minorities from top of the majority, but only in part. Its main purpose or its trust, he says, was not to defeat top of the majority, but to empower them. Now, James Madison in Federalist 63 says that the Constitution, the American Constitution, is unique insofar as it excludes totally the people in their collective capacity from any share in the government. Professor Amar's thesis is then that the people kept out of the government by the amended Constitution were brought back into the government by the Bill of Rights. But what people? When he says that, quote, the essence of the Bill of Rights was more structural than not and more majoritarian than common majoritarian, he has to be referring to local majorities on the whole, not national majorities. Sponsored by the Anti-Federalists, the Bill of Rights is intended to restore or to secure the rights of state and local majorities, to protect local institutions that somehow promote, as he says, an educated and virtuous electorate. And he makes a persuasive case. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, for example, can be read to mean that Congress shall make no law respecting state establishments of religion, thereby protecting those state establishments. The Second Amendment, by securing the right of the people to bear arms as part of local militias, does indeed reflect the anti-federalist spirit of national standing arms. Like Tocqueville, whom Professor Amar quotes on this point, the anti-federalists did indeed emphasize the political importance of the jury, and specifically the Fifth, Sixth, and Seventh Amendments. And he is surely right when he says the Ninth Amendment should be seen not as a statement of individual rights, but of the ultimate sovereignty of the people. Now, this point about the Ninth Amendment seems to me to deserve some elaboration, more than he gives it in his paper, and more than he, of course, gave today. In fact, as he might have pointed out, the anti-federalists were not completely satisfied with the Bill of Rights that came out of Congress. The Bill of Rights, as one of them, was no more than a pinch of snuff. Whipped Sullivan, a North Carolina friend of mine, told me, explained to me what it was. It's a kind of dessert. Whipped Sullivan, frothy and full of wind, formed only to please the palate. Now, what was missing from the Bill of Rights as needs to be understood? Well, in his definitive study on the Constitution of the Bill of Rights, Professor Story, Herbert Story, to whom you refer, makes that absolutely clear. What was missing was present in, for example, the Virginia Declaration of Rights. For example, quoting from that Declaration of Rights, that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights of which, when they enter into the state of society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. Virginia Declaration. Calling for a Bill of Rights during the Virginia ratification phase, Patrick Henry pointed to this provision especially. His colleague, Edmund Randolph, made the same point. What was missing in the Federal Bill of Rights as it came out of Congress was a perpetual standard around which the people might rally if or when the legislature should violate the rights of the limits of power. In other words, the Constitution should remind the people, as the Virginia Constitution reminded the people, of their ultimate sovereignty, of their right, quote, to alter and abolish the government, which, in their judgment, had violated the trust bestowed on it. Or, as still another Virginian put it, to renew and give it a fresh spring at stated periods. These rights were stated at the head, the very head of the Virginia Constitution, so why not, said one delegate, why not the head of this General Confederation? Those rights characterize the man, especially the true Republican, the citizen of this continent. Their enumeration at the head of the new Constitution can inspire and conserve the affection for the native country. They will be the first lesson of young citizens becoming men to sustain the dignity of their being. Well, Madison and the Federalists generally did not disagree with the principle of this. But as Story demonstrates, Madison especially was determined that a statement of this sort not be given a prominent place in your Constitution. Quoting Story, the problem with the Bill of Rights as a perpetual standard or a set of maxims to which the people might rally is that it might tend to undermine stable and effective government. Precisely because Madison was intent on establishing a government that would be stable and effective, he rejected the Virginia mob. He rejected it because, as Story puts it, the Virginia Declaration of Rights asserting a free government depends on a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. And Douglas doubted that. Hence, if my reading is correct, that perpetual standard or statement of first principles was not pressed before, it was consigned to the Ninth Amendment. There, but in a much less conspicuous place, and with language much more sober than Patrick Henry's, it served to remind the people, or served as a reminder to the people, that they are the source of the powers exercised by government. And incidentally, but not insignificantly, the Ninth Amendment, among other things, was cited in more than one of the secession assemblies, Virginia, for example, Virginia was soon to secede from the United States. One of the things, one of the authorities they cited was that Ninth Amendment. They were here reasserting that sovereign principle. Now, my chief quarrel, I suppose someone in my position has to have some quarrel, my chief quarrel with Professor Amar's thesis has to do with his association of Madison with this project of empowering local majorities as a means of checking the national government. No one worked harder than Madison to limit their capacity to do mischief. After all, in the Philadelphia Convention, Madison was the most persistent supporter of the so-called consulate provision, which would have had the authority to veto state legislation on political as well as constitutional grounds. And in his letter of October 17, 1787, to Jefferson, who was in Paris at the time, Madison explained his new constitution, he points to this one material defect of the absence of that strong limitation in the constitution on state legislation. He said the injustice of state laws has been so frequent and so flagrant as to affirm the most steadfast friends of Republicans. Now I'm persuaded that the anti-federalists sought the Bill of Rights as a means of empowering local majorities and thereby preventing the national government from misusing its powers. But for that purpose, Madison placed his hope elsewhere. You see, he put it at the end of Federalist 10. The extent and proper structure of the Union, we need to hold a Republican remedy for the diseases most concerned to Republican government. Now, Professor Amar cites a passage from Federalist 51, which you heard here, where Madison says, it is of great importance to make a republic not only to guard the society against the oppression of rulers, but to guard one part of the society against the injustice of the other part. Amar continues by saying that the conventional understanding of the Bill of Rights seems to focus almost exclusively on the second issue, protection of the ruling against the majority, while ignoring the first, protection of the people against selfish government. What was first in the minds of those who framed the Bill of Rights, he says, was protecting the people from self-interested government. But it was not first in Madison's mind. And I think Professor Amar could discover this by focusing on or reading and paying some attention to the passage that follows, or the sentences that follow the passage he quotes. The passage continues as follows, Fellows 51. Different interests necessarily exist in different classes of citizens. If a majority is united by a common interest, the rights of the minority will be insecure. There are but two methods of providing against the sea world, he goes on to talk about that. Well, what we're left with here is a traditional understanding of the origin of the Bill of Rights, sponsored indeed by anti-federalists, and not that it was consisted by James Madison, sponsored by the anti-federalists on the theory that the new national government would misuse its powers. Professor Amar has given us the best account yet of the means by which they hope to start against that misuse. The fact is, of course, that after incorporation into the 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights has been used primarily to protect individuals and minorities against local majorities, and that takes nothing away from his particular argument. It does, however, illustrate something. In fact, it demonstrates something, that Madison was justified in thinking that the original Constitution was defective and not the providing a sufficient check on those local authorities. Thank you.
Thank you. Being Akhil's colleague here, and also being in a school where the dean is known as Guido, I have to call him Akhil, so it won't be Professor Amar each time. Akhil has told us that the conventional understanding of the Bill of Rights is that it protects minorities and individuals from majority tyranny. And he's done us a great service in presenting the case for an alternative or supplementary vision of the bill's dominant motif, the protection of majority rights, or as he sometimes says, the protection of collective rights, a term I'm not sure I fully understand. But he argues that the primary focus of the bill was to protect the popular majority against an unrepresentative or self-interested Congress. Now, there is much in this paper that is brilliant and important. But this morning, I want to share some concerns I have, the areas where Akhil's version may share some of the dangers or confusions of what he terms the conventional account. And I'm going to end by noting several instances where I think Akhil may have been too quick to trumpet the populist motif in the bill. Perhaps what I'm really doing is adding yet, reminding us of a third theme in the Bill of Rights. Now first, like the conventional understanding, Akhil's version lumps together individual rights and minority rights. Thus, Akhil's account, like the conventional one, places majority rights and individual rights as opposed to one another. But individual rights do not always, or even most of the time, stand in opposition to the sentiment of the majority. The essence of an individual right is precisely that, that it attaches whether the person is in the majority or the minority. The great danger of thinking of individual rights as synonymous with minority rights is that we are apt to abjure reliance on democratic institutions ever to secure them. We come and think that we have to rely on, for instance, the federal courts. We also work ourselves into the wrong-headed notion that every time a majority acts, it is acting in opposition to individual rights. That is not true. Many threats to individual liberties come from outside majority institutions, indeed from outside the government agencies altogether. We do well to recall that the Bill of Rights left intact the ability of shifting popular majorities to act through the criminal law, for instance, to prevent tyranny of the many by the few. A second and related concern I have is the repeated invocation of this idea of collective rights. How exactly are collective rights different from individual rights held by a different? To label a constitutional right a collective right has too often meant that particular individuals are denied exercise of that right on the ground that it is being exercised by appropriate surrogates. I'll give a quick example. The Supreme Court has recently held that there's a First Amendment right to access to criminal trials and certain pretrial hearings, even if the defendant would waive his separate Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. But is this First Amendment right an individual right or a collective right? Well, in some cases recently, the modern organized press has organized, in a, has argued in essence, that it's a collective right, and that the press is the appropriate mediating institution to exercise that right on behalf of all the people. So where courtroom seats are limited, the press should have first dibs at those seats. But if we look at the right of access as an individual right, then the limited seats should be distributed on some basis that gives equal rights to all individual claimants, such as a lottery or first come, first serve. While I quite agree with Ralph Miller that the First Amendment is at the core of our liberties, I think there's a danger in placing the press above as a mediating institution or otherwise. Another consequence of downplaying the individual rights motif of the Bill of Rights, of course, any appeal does not read this out of the bill. But another danger is well illustrated by the exclusionary rule. Appeal has demonstrated by Justice White before me, I think, that the warrant clause is not at the core of the Fourth Amendment. That the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is the requirement that searches and seizures be reasonable. And with this much, I wholeheartedly agree. But Akil also seems attracted to the idea that because the Fourth Amendment has the term the people, providing the people to be free from unreasonable seizures, this suggests that the Fourth Amendment rights are collective rights. To be fair, Akil did not pursue this idea in this article, but others have. Professor Anthony Amsterdam has made a point similar to Akil's, that the Fourth Amendment says the people, and is therefore about government structure, not about individual rights of affected persons. From this premise, he and others have sought to justify application of the exclusionary rule for Fourth Amendment violations, as well as relaxed standing requirements, for instance, to raise Fourth Amendment claims. If, as I would contend, the Fourth Amendment is about individual rights, then the exclusionary rule is much more difficult to justify. Exclusion of probative evidence obtained by the police does nothing to address the individual's rights that may have been violated. As Judge Friendly explained in his lament about turning the Bill of Rights into a code of criminal procedure, the exclusionary rule merely gives the defendant a windfall at the expense of public security and the integrity of criminal trials. Rather than excluding whatever evidence may be traced to an illegal search, the defendant should be permitted to obtain appropriate redress in civil law proceedings. Moreover, the victim of an illegal search who is not there after charging the crime should also be able to obtain appropriate redress. Indeed, it seems to me that the significance of the words the people in the Fourth Amendment is precisely that it protects all of the people, unlike the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, which are directed just to the accused or to defendants. Now, a related concern I have with both the conventional account and Akil's is that they read the Bill of Rights as largely designed to disable government, in particular, to disable the Congress and the President in his legislative capacity. In the conventional account, the legislative branch is disabled where it would trample on the rights of individuals or minorities. In Akil's, it is disabled where it would be self-interested or unrepresentative. And both of these visions, I think, have much to commend them. But both of them fail to credit another important theme in the Bill of Rights. Much of the bill is not directed towards disabling or incapacitating Congress and the President. Rather, it's directed towards protecting every citizen from the arbitrary actions of bureaucrats, enforcers, law enforcement agents, and other autocratic administrators of federal law. Moreover, I think the Bill of Rights recognizes the important role that Congress and the President, in his legislative capacity, have to play in thus protecting the liberties of the people. The Bill of Rights recognizes the special value of law. That word is repeated throughout the bill, too. Law in the very specific sense in which it's defined in the original Constitution. A bill passed by both houses, not vetoed by the President or cheating override. A bill which is not ex post facto nor vilipendiary. The Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment is, of course, the greatest example of the Bill of Rights' reliance on law, which means reliance on our representative Republican institutions. A law, statute, may deprive any person of life, liberty, or property, but only a law, not a government official acting outside or without the law. Less significantly, the Third Amendment recognized the importance of Congress deciding in advance the manner in which soldiers may be quartered during a time of war. The Sixth Amendment recognizes that Congress and the President shall decide in advance the legislative districts in which criminal trials will be held. And even the First Amendment, which along with the Senate are the only amendments specifically directed at confining Congress. Even the First Amendment can be seen as enabling the legislative branch to do the bidding of the people. As Akhil's account does suggest, though he doesn't dwell on this, so I just want to discuss it. A petition by the people might present the need for government protection to enhance the security of the people. The people may petition the government for the purpose of government action, not simply to prevent it from acting. Now, James Madison, we all want to quote James Madison, he certainly recognized this third thing, the need to commit government to act with due regard for the desires of the people. Even as he recognized these other two things, or importance of the Bill of Rights in terms of avoiding the danger of only overwhelming majorities and the danger of attenuated representation. As Madison said to Thomas Jefferson in his letter of October 1788 about the Bill of Rights, a letter which he quotes from, but not this, this passage. It's been remarked that there is a tendency in all governments to an augmentation of power at the expense of liberty. But the remark is usually understood does not appear to be well founded. Power, when it has attained a certain degree of energy and independence, generally goes on to further degrees. But when below that degree, the direct tendency is to further degrees of relaxation. It is a melancholy reflection that liberty should be equally exposed to danger, whether the government has too much or too little power. What I'm making here, that the Bill of Rights does not always seek to disable our republican institutions, is obviously related to my first point. The protection of individual rights may also be protection of the rights of majorities. When a law enforcement agent engages in an unreasonable search of your home, this is government oppression. But it is often not the oppression of an unrepresentative or self-interested Congress or president, as Akhil's model would suggest. It's also often not the tyranny of a majority over an oppressed minority, as the conventional model suggests. Rather, the problem is often a government agent quite unresponsive both to elected officials and to popular sentiment. Let me take 2 minutes to express some reservations about Hill's reading of the petition in the First Amendment and the grand jury in the Fifth Amendment as great populist institutions. Again, I think there's more individualism and less populism than Akhil may stress in his paper. Now, the image of grand jurors as populist protectors is somewhat confused. Akhil has quoted James Milton and cited the grand jury presidents protesting the 1816 congressional pay raise as examples of the populist grand juries which favors conditions. But this is not the grand jury that is enshrined in the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment secures a very different function for the grand jury. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of the grand jury. The difference between a presentment and an indictment is that an indictment was drawn up by a prosecutor, whereas a presentment was presented by a grand jury on its own knowledge. The Fifth Amendment refers to a very specific type of presentment, an accusation of wrongdoing. Nor do I think it was a grand jury composed of the people, regular citizens. In many states, at least, the qualifications for grand jury were greater than those of petit juries or to exercise the franchise. It seems doubtful to me that the grand jury envisioned by the Fifth Amendment was ever ordained as a singularly popular voice on public affairs, much less that current law would countenance this species of political vigilantism. In any event, it's not a function that founders thought warranted constitutional protection. Petitions were not necessarily populist devices either. Let me just quote from you from a source which I got from Akhil, which he cited. In the 1670s, certain Connecticut petitioners asked that roads be built for them to reach their meeting house on the Sound. This petition, in turn, was opposed by other petitioners who complained that road construction would destroy their pasture lands. And note that these competing petitions did not involve a dispute between the people and their agents, as Akhil's account might suggest. I think they represented a dispute between competing interests of different people. And we may think of petitioning at the frame as having performed some of the same functions that lobbying does today. The people, assuming there are people behind the lobbies, rarely speak in a single voice, and Congress must decide which of the many conflicting voices it will keep. To finally return to the words of the First Amendment, the redress of grievances sought by a First Amendment petition is not necessarily referred to a populist antagonism against the legislature. It refers also to antagonisms among the people, antagonisms that the legislature, thanks to the framers, is there to resolve.
In addition to any more general comments you may have on Professor Long's paper, the land battle will focus on key areas, the laws of particularly important sexual rights in the Bill of Rights, and that is the rights to a jury trial in criminal cases. That's a long one. Thank you.
Akhil has been talking about a larger perception of the Bill of Rights, and in many ways it's common. I want to talk about a different aspect of the Bill of Rights, which is its diminution in ways that I think have not been understood as regards the right to criminal due process. I'm coming here, in effect, as something of a pallbearer to talk about the disappearance, the subversion and substantial disappearance of the right to criminal due process. The criminal jury trial right appears twice in the Constitution. People who have the booklet, which was the registration journal, might look along with me. It's first in Article 3, and there, in the middle of the page, on page section 2, in the third paragraph, the text says, I quote, the trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, drop that qualifier, the trial of all crimes shall be by jury. And we know in context that that was understood to be serious crime. The idea was that felonies, that crimes could get serious criminal sanctions were meant to be tried by jury. The Sixth Amendment, one of the few instances I can think of, dramatic duplication in the Constitution, which is otherwise such a sparse document. The Sixth Amendment comes right back, says it all over again. Slightly different language. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury in the state. Obviously, there's different business there. They're trying to deal with the venue and the choice of the jury and so forth where it comes from. But the notion that the framers had was that they were going to pin down, both in the constitutional text itself, and then again in the Bill of Rights, they were going to pin down something that they regarded as, to use an overused word, really fundamental. Really, really fundamental. And so they used a very fundamental word. They said, all! And they meant it. They meant it because they had experienced it. In the world in which they lived, both sides of the Atlantic, Anglo-American criminal procedure was a system in which every case of serious crime in the 18th century went to full jury trial. In the rare situation in which some pathetic accused didn't want to go to jury trial, was caught in the act, abject, wanted to get it over with, whatever it was. We have evidence, excellent historical evidence, suggesting that the judges try again and again to talk them out of it. Don't do that. Take your trial. It's possible, by implication what the judges were saying was. It's possible the jury may let you off, or it's possible the jury may employ some of the mitigating powers that they had to return lesser offenses as the jury. Now, in our own day, jury trial continues to occupy a very central place in the formal law, the law of the books, and in the mythology of the law. The constitutions haven't changed, obviously, as the language I read. The federal constitution is mirrored in every state constitution and has been right the way along from the conception of the union. These constitutions haven't changed. So the formal law is the same. And indeed, if you are to form a picture of our practice from popular culture, you would, I think, not be alert to the proposition that very much has changed. You can turn on the TV and get at almost any time a steady stream of dramas in which some contest for the verdict of a jury has been conducted, and then Perry Mason or whoever these new ones are, LA Law or whatever, I'm dating myself. You know how it all works. Well, in truth, criminal jury trial has largely disappeared in this country. It's simply a gone. Can you find it? Of course you can find it. But it isn't characteristic. Can you find a hippopotamus in the Bronx? Yeah, there's one in the Bronx Zoo. But it's got nothing to do with life in the Bronx. It's a goner. And so is stunning. So is criminal jury trial. The criminal justice system now disposes of virtually all cases of serious crime by plea, by plea bargaining, or in a couple of jurisdictions in the state systems by non-jury trial procedures, one character from mid-Atlantic states, kind of fascinating divergence from the national norm. But depending on the jurisdiction, anything up to 99% of all felony convictions are by plea, 99% above. And this non-trial procedure has become quite simply the ordinary dispositive procedure of American law. That's how we do business. That's the reality. And it's not really pleasant reality. Plea bargaining is a subversion of the formal law. It works by threat. We tell the accused, you want your right to jury trial? Yes. Take the right to jury trial that's in the Bill of Rights and in the Constitution. Please go right ahead. But if you claim it and are convicted, guess what we're going to do? We're going to punish you twice. Once for what you're convicted of, and once for having the temerity to exercise your right to jury trial. And that is how we exactly come out and say that, but that's what we convey, that's what we do by the sentence differential that we impose, whether the form of the plea bargain is charge bargaining or the sentence bargaining, which is probably more relevant. How did criminal jury trial come to disappear? There's some monographic work that has been done on this. I've done some of it, others have. Al Alshuler is the one that worked on this, and there's a lot more that needs to be known about it. But the basic story is fairly well understood. Criminal jury trial, as the framers understood it, as it was practiced on both sides of the Atlantic basin in the second half of the 18th century, was a summary proceeding. A dozen or more in a single day to a single trial court, a dozen or more cases of full felony jury trial to go forward. The procedures were proved. Lawyers were seldom involved. There was no voir dire of juries. The juries tended to be the same jury start to finish. There was almost no challenge practice. The jurors were experienced veterans who served again and again, therefore didn't need much instructing. There was almost no law of evidence. Because there were no lawyers, there were none of the lawyers' motions and manipulations that were characteristic of modern procedure. Because there was essentially no appeal for error, for Angus, the judge wrote out of town on the size, there was very limited appellate rights, and therefore all the motions that are associated with provoking error, protecting appellate review, all of that stuff was not present. This was not a dream. criminal justice. The system that the framers contemplated was, and it did constitutionalize, right, was a lot rougher system than anything that I think would find favor. I am not, in other words, yearning for the good old days when we tried 15 felony jury trials a day in the Old Bailey and comparable places on this side of the border. I think that there are real reasons why we have been led to try to increase the level of safety. I think what actually happened was the capture of the criminal trial by lawyers, the lawyerization arrived, the adversary system, the silence of the abuse. I think we did our safeguards in ways that turned out to be clumsy, turned out to be wrong, turned out to be so costly in their time demands and the like that in the end we couldn't give our routine procedure to everybody who was entitled. The Europeans, who had a much worse criminal justice system than we did for many centuries, turned out not to have made that mistake, with the result that today you wind up with, in a place like West Germany, you wind up in West Germany. Insurance system. What you have is a criminal justice system in which every case of serious crime has a panel which includes lay participants and full trial. We, on the other hand, having for a very complicated series of historical reasons come at it the way we've done, wind up with a system which says you are entitled to the most leisurely trial procedure the world has ever known, with a level of safeguard that would boggle the mind, but please don't ask for it. And if you do, boy, will we have it. If by chance you open the bag. I don't like the word, in case you haven't. I think it's generally not a good idea to have a constitution which is full of glorious illusory rights that doesn't give you. I think there ought to be a rather closer correspondence between the text of a fundamental document and what's in there. I think that's probably a pretty good principle of good governance. I think that plea bargaining is dangerous because, in effect, it concentrates power in a low visibility decision maker, the prosecutor. Plea bargaining has, in effect, transferred to public prosecutors the powers of jurors and judges in our courts. That is to say that the powers of adjudication and of sentencing are collapsed into the negotiating process, which is handled by the prosecutor's house. I believe that plea bargaining is wrong and dangerous because it is essentially coercive. I think that a legal system that comes to depend upon coercing people out of their rights in order to have the thing be functional at all is, by definition, a failed system. I really mean by definition. The system can't work by honoring its own premise. Instead, it has to put people under ferocious pressure. And that pressure is real, and in some cases, not a lot, but in some cases, I think it really does lead to false verdicts. Plea bargaining and false verdicts. People can really get in bad false verdicts against themselves. You make a threat, look, if the threat is 50 cent fine or death penalty, I don't care what I'm accused of course I do. Now, we don't have that level of disparity, but we do have a high enough level of disparity in the system that a lot of people feel that they are coerced. There are serious problems of appearances. Plea bargaining conceals valuable information. There is a lingering distaste in substantial sections of the community that something was wrong about the way James Earl Ray was sent off to prison in Tennessee, that he never got the trial. There is, in other words, a positive externality to criminal trials. Of disclosure of information. And when it came time to plea bargain Spiro Agnew, they learned that the Justice Department had as a special part of that deal the notion that they would spread on the public record the evidence that they assembled in order that that sense of doubt about what really happened would not be real. And of course, I think there are a bunch of moral arguments about the nation of criminal sanction for offended. I don't think they're half guilty. I think they're half guilty or not. Any justification for plea bargaining? Let me tell you what the Supreme Court's holding is. It's Santabello against New York 404 U.S. 1971 Chief Justice Burger. Listen to this. Plea bargaining needs to be encouraged because, quote, every criminal charge was subjected to a full-scale trial common the states and the federal government would be multiplied by many times the number of judges in court and circuits. Close quote. Translation, we can't afford the building. Sheer expense. The only halfway serious academic justification I've ever seen for emphasized halfway is the article by Frank Easterbrook in 512 of Journal of Legal Studies, which says, well, look, it works like a market, and lots of individual U titles are being taken advantage of, are made account of there as we process the thing through the system. People are behaving very rationally in when and how they waive their rights. And that's all true. It is indeed a quite glorious Turkish drug market that we created in the world of public frameworks. It does indeed look a lot like a market, but I have to think a market proponent though I am, but that's a curse and not an achievement when you're talking about what the functions of adjudication in the public interest in the criminal process really are. In other words, I think Frank's marvelous paper happens to assume the most important question and issue, which is what is the purpose of the jury trial guarantee? Was it meant to be sold at the Turkish market together with the other rugs? And the answer is not. I'm left to say that I think that we need to give a great deal more attention to how we handle criminal adjudication than we do. I believe non-trial concessionary procedure is wrong. I don't think we can ever, on the other hand, give that which we today promise, which is full-scale adversary criminal procedure. The framers constitutionalized and contemplated non-adversary summary jury trial. That's gone. We can't bring it back. I think that we're likely to wind up paying attention to trying to return elements of real adjudication into probably the Rule 11 hearing or some such thing, that is to say, into the procedures that we now use to ventilate the plea for voluntariness and adequate factual basis. And I would even hope that we might learn from the Europeans who came to look at us about a century ago and took back with them the notion that lay participation in criminal adjudication is profoundly important, A, but B, you can't do it according to the Americans. We've proved them right. We don't do it either. The result is they have more of our system than we do because they use laypersons in adjudication in a way that works, whereas we have a system of adversary jury trial, which is so complicated that we can't give it to anybody, and therefore we're left to live the lie of the repeal right to criminal jury.
We'll take about 10 or 15 minutes to have a discussion on the panel, and we'll open it up to questions from the audience. One of those choices we've had in the panel is that Coach Thomas has made. I think the question about nodding. This may be kind of a comment related to the panel myself.
I think each of the commentators has made a very thoughtful point. Let me just try to respond to one or two from each. Professor Burns, I think, very usefully pointed us to the secession experience, in which by simple majorities, especially convened elections, the people of South Carolina, of Virginia, etc., claimed this right to alter and abolish their existing government. My own view is that they had popular sovereignty, a right in thinking that it implied a right of conventions and simple majority mechanisms within those conventions to alter even the most fundamental ground rules of society. But they got the issue of nation versus state wrong. I'm with Lincoln thinking the original Constitution, that the preamble, we the people of the United States, means the people of the United States as a whole, and that the original Constitution is very different from the Articles of Confederation, which was predicated on the sovereignty of the people of each state. So I'm in a somewhat awkward position of really saying two things. That I believe in national popular majoritarianism and popular sovereignty, And it's true that the Bill of Rights was promoted by a lot of anti-federalists, but they're using the word people that was there in the original Constitution before, so the preamble. They don't say peoples in the 10th Amendment. They say people. They talk about respect the states, plural, respectively, but they don't say the peoples respectively. And I think as a textualist that matters, and there are other things. But what's interesting about important about the invocation secession is this dominant theme of sort of popular sovereignty and majoritarianism that whatever you think about secession continues to exist at the state constitutional level, the state constitution being amended by simple popular majorities in secession conventions. Second thing is about Madison, that's Burns mentioned. And I think he's absolutely right that Madison's vision was different from the Bill of Rights as it came out, and I should have probably flagged that a little bit more. Madison wanted the original Bill of Rights to apply against the states, precisely because this is the author of Federalist Number 10 who thinks the states are a big part of the problem. He loses on that. Madison is less of a majoritarian than many of the other important folks. James Wilson, for example, is much more of a populist and majoritarian in my mind than Madison. But one minor caveat, if we instead of looking at Madison and the Philadelphia Convention, not as great a majoritarian, not a big believer, as big a believer in the state's rights, but we instead sort of look at what Madison's going to become very soon. The Alien Sedition Act controversy is going to be a defender of a certain kind of federalism, ability of state legislatures to challenge the federal government, and of national majoritarianism. It's basically a national electorate who kind of adjudicates the constitutionality of the Alien Sedition Act in the election of 1800. And even before that, you start to see Madison taking states' rights a little bit more seriously than he did in Philadelphia, in opposing the constitutionality of the first bank, for example. So Madison's a very interesting case study. And I'm very grateful for Professor Burns for reminding us of Madison's thought. Professor Stitt, I actually should say, I think maybe a lot of great points. Let me just pick up on two quick things. One, I agree with her that it's a mistake, it's an oversimplification to say that the only rights here are majoritarian or collective. To the extent that I said that I misspoke. What I do want to do, however, is remind us of the tradition that I think the conventional accounts have just basically made all that invisible. The petition clause is a good example. Of course, individuals can petition, and of course, sometimes petitions will present conflicting individual interests. But a lot of times we miss the important role of petitions when it's a majority of citizens complaining about unrepresentative government. Like, for example, when Congress for the first time since 1789 and 1816 votes itself a pay increase, and boy, there are lots of petitions on that, and an populist petition. So absolutely right about it, Kate. Second, very briefly on the word people in the Fourth Amendment. I think Kate is absolutely right that Tony Amsterdam takes this phrase and tries to make arguments about the exclusionary rule and collective rights. I want to disassociate myself from that in two ways. One, I don't think actually in the Fourth Amendment the people, that phrase, is as strong as elsewhere, precisely because it's modified by the word persons, which is much more individualistic, two separate times in the rest of the world. I emphasize people, I think, a little bit more in earlier drafts, and two of the panelists were going to be here this afternoon, Owen Fiss and Mary Lawson, talked me out of that, and I'm very thankful to them for that. And you should stick around with the afternoon and hear their comments on all sorts of other things as well. I'm not a big fan of the exclusionary rule either, and the reason is illustrative of the main thing. What judges have done is they've taken the Fourth Amendment, they've made it the province of judges to enforce in an exclusionary rule context, focusing on the criminal context. The old way you litigated the Fourth Amendment was the government official broke into your house, you sued him for trespass and damages, and the jury rather than the judge decided. And you know what? We don't do that today because judges created a thing called good faith immunities, not from the exclusionary rule, but from damage actions, even when government officials are acting unconstitutionally, they are personally immune from damages in a way that they never were at common law, and never were even as late as 1925. And so this is an interesting story about a shift away from juries as protectors of a Bill of Rights values and towards judges. And so I'm glad that Kate sort of brought the final thing about John Langbein's presentation. Note how we've shifted ever so subtly from a perspective of about jury trial, about popular participation, democratic self-governance. We have juries because these are people's representatives in the judiciary, just like the people's representatives in the legislature, and it's about really their interests and their rights. To a more defendant-oriented perspective, it's unfair for the defendant to get hammered in these safeguarding kind of ways. I think that's reflected, interestingly, in one key move that Professor Langbein makes. He says, well, you know, the text says of Article 3, and I agree with him, the trial of all crimes shall be by jury, by jury. But then he actually introduces a little word, he says, well, any serious crimes. I'm not so sure it means serious crimes. Maybe some serious crimes in England or in states which have differently worded constitutions. But there's a nice piece in the Chicago Law Review called The Petty Offenders Have No Peers that critiques the idea that there's even a petty crime exception to jury trial. Hugo Black also believed there was no petty crime exception to jury trial. Why did Professor Langbein maybe suggest that there was after sort of hammering so hard on the text? Well, if you adopt more of an individual rights defendant-oriented perspective to jury trial, in a way where it's a serious offense, the defendant has more to lose, and so there's more of an interest in jury trial than where there's a petty offense. But if you focus instead on sort of the jury as being about democratic participation, maybe there's as much of a value there even in petty offenses. I don't want to push the point too hard, because maybe you don't want to push that hard. The defendant's interest is key here because there's not a similar mandate on the civil side. So where you don't have an individual defendant subject to the extraordinary coercive power of government, where you have individual versus individual, like in case petition case, jury trial may be waivable by the parties in a way that wasn't true in the criminal context. I think that reminds us, and here I'll close, with Kate's big point that there are individual rights aspects to these things as well. All I wanted to do is prevent us from thinking that that's all that's going on, that there are all these other things that are going on, and I think we've lost a lot of them.
Let me start, sir. I kind of wish to put the point in the to watch us. Any other panelists have anything to add? We'll go to questions from the audience. Yes, sir, the gentleman in the blue shirt, please stand and
I was just wondering, a little louder, please. I was wondering if you thought that the lack of jury trials is an indication of disenfranchisement of the American people that they deal with for government as a result of the bureaucratic elite that has developed in a lot of governments in the legislature as a result of 90% return rate or growth of administrative regulation.
Repeat the question. Well, he calls me a flutterball, and I'm not going to get it. He wonders whether there's a connection between jury trials and a larger sense of dissatisfaction and suspicion of ruling authorities. I need wiser, more broad-gauge intellects to make those connections than I. As far as I'm concerned, I think this was probably just historically a legal technical development, push and counter-push as we developed much higher crime rates, we developed the lawyerization of the trial, as these pressures mounted sometime in the second half of the 19th century, we began to get serious levels of non-trial disciplinary cases, serious crime. And those moves were worked out already by the 1920s. Raymond Moley, in a famous article in Volume 2, I think, of the Southern California Law Review, pointed out that we were down to only 20% jury trial rates that early. This has been a long development. Frank Eastwood and I were talking out in the hallway earlier, and Frank made the point, which is absolutely correct, that this had been a 90-day change. If the framers ordered a jury trial, the criminal jury trial, on day one and on day two, we had moved to the system we've had today. I mean, there's been a revolution could have. This was a slow interstitial change in which a bunch of different things happened, and nobody saw the whole picture, and yet there was no going back on the end. Appeal. While I have the microphone, since I'm not going to get back, let me say that the main reason that the framers said all criminal cases is they were not planning on having the federal courts being small claims courts. We have trivialized the federal courts. We vastly demanded the scope of federal jurisdiction, both civil and criminal matters. But they thought that the almost all federal criminal business, almost all criminal business in this country was going to be a state business, and that the federal business was going to be a handful of very serious offenses, either sedition or some revenue offenses with the excise and so forth. But they were not looking for big box office, large volume federal criminal jurisdiction. Therefore, and you'll pick this up in the primary and corporate article in our review, there's plenty of reason for thinking that it makes complete sense to read out of to apply into the criminal trial guarantee the notion that it was a serious crime. But there's a lot of Supreme Court law on that, and I'd say it's better than the Supreme Court plea bargaining law.
Yeah, I have to say something about plea bargaining here. I don't know why I'm getting involved in this, but I'm sitting right next to him. Speaking of half full and half empty.
Tell them what you did for a living before you came.
I didn't sell the right to jury trial for very much. It's the right to trial. We keep saying jury trial, but we're really talking about trial. If you as a defendant say, look at, I'll waive the jury, you get 3 months off. It's your way to trial. And often you should understand that's the way it works. The defendant, his lawyer, comes in and makes this offer. I agree it's selling. I agree with a lot of the points that John made. But let's understand this. Why can the defendant sell these rights? Because we've given them to him. We have, and these are valuable rights from the government's perspective. The right to a law, look at New York State, the right to a voir dire of 2 weeks. And of course, John recognizes some of this stuff. But the reason that the defendant may be able to go from 5 years if he's convicted of trial to 9 months if he pleads is because his constitutional rights, which he is trading in for less time in jail, his constitutional rights are worth that much. I dare say that at the time the Constitution was founded, the procedural trial rights of defendants were not nearly so great, therefore couldn't be sold for that much. I do not intend this to be a justification for plea bargaining, but rather to understand, as I think you did allude to, that plea bargaining, as we know it, couldn't have happened without the great growth in procedural trial rights of the defendant. And as long as we allow those rights to be alienable, as long as we allow him to sell, he will have it. He will do so.
I see a member with the least trusted branch of government.
I would like to regain the other half of my intellectual respectability. John was supposed to give the only half. I won't comment on Akhil's paper because I haven't read it, but I'm pleading that he and I will engage in a market transaction by which I'll be able to acquire it. But with respect to John, the critical question for plea bargaining and whether there is some constitutional problem has always been one of benchmarking, I have thought. If you assume with Kate Stith that what is going on is that a reasonable sentence, an appropriate sentence, will be fixed after trial, and the defendant is getting a favor for selling his constitutional rights, then you don't have any problem with plea bargaining. If you assume, on the other hand, with John Langbein, that the just sentence is being fixed after the plea bargain, and that what happens after the trial is a barbarous sentence, then you have a great deal of trouble with plea bargaining. And the difficulty is figuring out which of these states of the world holds. Now, we have in civil cases a much higher percentage of settlements than we do in criminal cases. A smaller percentage of civil cases goes to trial for criminal, although when you look in the Seventh Amendment, there's a right to jury trial for all cases worth more than $20. And John Langbein's not terribly worried about the settlement of civil cases because he is confident that if a civil case goes to trial, the judge, the jury, or the judge will figure out at the end of the trial what the actual damages are based on some objective method for creating damages. John will, of course, object to punitive damages, but even throwing punitive damages out, there is that method. And if the plaintiff settles for less than that, then that's a mutually agreeable deal. No one thinks of that as a penalty for standing on trial. John is not nearly so sanguine about that for the criminal process. And the thing that is missing in an exchange between Kate and John, or between John and me, is this benchmarking method. Now, I should have thought that John would change his view now that we have the sentencing guidelines, which define appropriate sentences. But he won't, because he will say, and there'll be no way to refute it, that everything in the sentencing guidelines has been jacked up to make it possible to engage in this transaction. It turns out to be no really satisfactory way of resolving it, but I hope it ought to be clear that that's where the core of any debate ought to lie. Once you have one of these conceptions or the other about what's happening, almost everything else falls out very quickly.
The first word that we read in the Constitution, and I read out too, is all legislative power. Herein granted shall be in the Constitution. Now, all the time I've heard about legislative power in the court, and it doesn't say all legislative power not herein granted shall be in the court. Can you follow this through? Yes, sir.
I'm not quite sure what was expected of me.
Well, why are we here discussing about legislative power in the courts when the we're talking about the Constitution? When the Constitution says all legislative power, now here in granted, all legislative power in the courts, not I mean, is that in the Congress, not in the courts. But all we're talking about here is legislative power in the courts. The courts have judicial power, not legislative power.
I'm not quite sure if everyone in this panel would agree with you. In the first place, I'm going to have to point out that your reference to the first article of the Constitution is absolutely correct. But of course, the president doesn't indeed share legislative powers, but that's by and by. Would you describe plea bargaining as a legislative power? Is that sort of thing in mind?
Well, I am talking generally, but of course that would tie in with it, because the question ultimately will come not to the legislature, but it comes to the court. But how can it be? We're talking about federal government, not state right now.
Well, I think you're pointing to something that we really weren't discussing this morning. I suspect what you have in mind is what goes on the popular standard of judicial activism. I invite that.
That's the term we use, activism.
Yeah, well, no, we're not taking this time discussing that.
I'd like to have a gentleman. Yes, sir.
I'd just like to ask Professor Amar. I think you've done a very good textual analysis of the Bill of Rights, but it seems to fly in the face of the political and intellectual history of the period. Specifically, before the federal constitution, there was a revolutionary constitution in Pennsylvania which provided for a unicameral legislature and a wide franchise. It seems to me, given the choice between being able to participate on a daily basis or more regularly voting for my representatives in the chance every now and then to call a vote at a convention to change the government, that perhaps the Pennsylvania Constitution was perhaps more inclusive and more democratic. Second, if you look at some of the things the framers themselves said, Professor Burns has mentioned Madison, but Jefferson, for example, who was the greatest, one of the greatest defenders of the Bill of Rights, had a very hierarchical view of education, in which there would be public education at a level for sixth grade for some people and continuing on. So that, and in fact, when he wrote back from Paris, was so afraid of the urban canai, as he called it, that that was the belief that permeated his ideology of the open farmer. So it seems to me that these people were really, their intellectual heritage were really the gentry in England at 1689 who wrote that Bill of Rights, and unless perhaps there was some method of false consciousness involved, the idea of inclusion as something, well, it's one of their views.
Two thoughts on that. You're absolutely right that there are lots and lots of constitutions, Pennsylvania State Constitution of 1776, various ancient models that that framers had before them, that as a matter of ordinary day-to-day government seem to bring the people into government much more regularly into the legislature. And Professor Burns, rightly, invokes Madison's number 63, and says that's not the model of the federal constitution. And if you look at Article 1, well, if you look at Article 3, you see a pretty elitist institution. You see Frank Easterbrook. If you look at Article 1 and 2, you know, with like tenure and all the rest, if you look at Articles 1 and 2, you see again the people somewhat distanced from ordinary day-to-day legislative action. I do think if you look at Article 7, which is the constitutive founding act, you see a profoundly participatory and democratic and majoritarian provision when it came to making the Constitution the supreme law of the land. And my argument is there's a similar democratic right to alter or amend anything in it, including Article 3 and Frank's tenure, including Articles 1 and 2. Now, how are the people going to be able really to exercise any sort of real popular sovereignty if they're so totally excluded from day-to-day governance? That's the thrust of your question. That's where, for me, the jury becomes so central, not from the defendant's perspective, but as a way of bringing ordinary citizens day-to-day into government to get them to exercise those muscles of deliberation and participation that are essential for a system of, by, and for the people to be meaningful. And your final point was the invocation of public education. Tocqueville defines the jury as, quote, "if a gratuitous public school ever open to teach citizens about the rights of students." John hates this stuff, but it is the dominant tradition. It's Francis Lieber in 1850. It is letters from a federal farmer. It is Thomas Jefferson. They're focusing not just on the defendant perspective, but on the jury as a mechanism of public education in interesting ways. So is the militia, so is the church, a mechanism for democratic education. Churches, of course, are running schools those days, and that's why it's important to protect churches for democratic education. And believe it or not, militias play this role as well. And if you want to take seriously popular sovereignty today, I do think we need to take seriously adding education. And that connects back with some of the things that I think Bob Ellison was very thoughtfully expounding yesterday.
I think we've got a fighting word with that.
The idea that we're running this criminal justice system with these jurors in order to give them a little bit of free tuition seems to me to be fantastic. Yes, one of the things you can say to excuse yourself for interfering with their personal lives is that they get a look at how government works and isn't that nice. But that is not the purpose. By the way, it's a pretty awful experience to be a jury. You get locked up in some filthy room, sit around, and things usually like was well understood in a literature vastly more voluminous than some occasional Frenchman or German writer. Was state, even when they're nice and they smile like they said, they're dangerous. And what you're supposed to do about it is to diffuse power. And fascinatingly, even the Europeans, who in general have resisted our preoccupation with separation of powers as a way of dealing with the dangers of government power, and I think largely wisely, I'm not a big believer in separation of powers, even they, right there, said there's one place where our approach, which is in general get a better bureaucracy and control the heck out of it rather than worry about the separation of powers, and that tends to be my view of things. I'm not a big fan of a lot of what our friend did here, but I do have to say that the one thing where the Europeans agreed with James Madison and came over and took it back on the boat was the criminal justice system. It's low level, it's low visibility, it's out of the way, it's darn dangerous, it's very uncomfortable. What can happen to you in the criminal process? And it is too dangerous to entrust to ordinary bureaucrats without lay participation when you deal with serious crime. It's not a schoolhouse, it's serious.
I'd like to say a word on behalf of that French refugee. His notion of the jury, I think, is critical to the way of a splendid article in the Supreme Court Review by Ralph Lerner. You cite it in your article. It's entitled Supreme Court is Republican Schoolmaster. And he goes over the charges of grand juries made by the Ernest Supreme Court justices. It seemed to me that those federal judges at that time, on the circuit, between these grand juries and the criminal cases like Longmire and New York and so forth, had a real sense of the importance of the jury as you indicated. I have no doubt that, of course, the jury was important to criminal justice services, but it had this some purpose. I'm talking about that nothing is right.
Professor, I was interested in your opinion as you're discussing about collective rights, the important economic rights in the Constitution. In fact, you left to one side because amendments. Also, of course, the contract clause against the states is a powerful anti-majoritarian provision in the Constitution. Now, I'm wondering whether you make a demarcation between economic rights that were going to individuals and other sorts of rights, or if you go and maybe make a second step in your thesis, saying that you protect individual rights and you protect property rights, because property rights, by taking is an important bulwark against the government, because you need people with property to be a mediating institution to take back the government. And the first thing any government does is start distributing property to their friends to keep it in power. And if that is the case, I'm wondering if I would invite you to join in those of us who think that the Supreme Court should be much more vigorous enforcing that primary mediating institution, private property.
A couple of things. One, it's very interesting that in your formulation you invoke the Fifth Amendment. Of course, I know you were referring to the Takings Clause, but that's not the entire Fifth Amendment. And then one interesting question becomes, why is the Takings Clause there with the rest of the Fifth Amendment? It's a question that typically doesn't get asked because we focus on everything in such a clause-bound way. And takings is taught in property, and the Fourth Amendment is taught in criminal procedure, and what have you. Interestingly, the Takings Clause is the only provision of the Bill of Rights that was not proposed by any state ratifying conventions. Madison believed in it a lot, and I think this is very good evidence for Professor Burns' thesis that Madison's view was a little different from my overall sense of the original Bill of Rights. Madison slips this one in, I argue, along with a bunch of analytically unrelated provisions, in part because the dominant view of his contemporaries is somewhat different from his own view. Now, on the more general question about the contract clause, which is, of course, not the Bill of Rights,
the original Constitution and property generally. On the contracts clause, I'm very much with my classmate Mike Rappaport, who is a member of this society, who has written a very thoughtful piece about how the contract clause is structural in its nature, and it's in part about the legislative generality and prospectivity, just like the Bill of Attainder and Takings Clause. It's a note in the 93 Yale Law Journal. And so I see it as actually more structural, less about, it doesn't say, as Richard Epstein would like to say, freedom of contract, for good reasons. But you're absolutely right that there is this sort of central importance of property and protecting people, giving them literally a place to stand, a ground to stand on against that government tyranny. I think that connects up with the, some of the ideas of affirmative rights that Bob Ellison was trying to invoke yesterday. Today, what it may mean to have the kind of independence to be a citizen, stand against government, might not be to have 48 years in a mule, but to have some kind of voucher or other entitlements to education. But, here's the big but, I do not believe that government redistribution is an illegitimate purpose, at least after the adoption of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which is not just about income taxation, but about predictably progressive, that is, redistributive income taxation. There may be limits to the degree to which government can redistribute, but in this context, whatever the original understanding of distribution is, when you try to connect the dots between the Takings Clause and the Contracts Clause, and it goes back to the Attainder Clauses, and other things, as Professor Epstein nicely does, you have to update the story today and look similarly at the vision behind the 16th Amendment, which I do think is more redistributive, but I believe in the idea of property rights. I believe in so much that I think everyone should have some property. I think it's such a good thing. And that's what 48 years in a mule is all about. Yeah.
I'll thank you for the